Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I love soundcheck. I listen every day.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Let's talk about magic for a moment. Not illusions or sleight of hand, but real magic. Something that you know exists because you can feel it, even though you can't explain it. Like sometimes a piece of music or a poem or a work of art will send a shiver down your spine or make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. It's just a momentary thing, a momentary rush. But it's real. How does music do that? Let me give you an example that works for me. In the piece Different Trains by Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Steve Reich, he takes the sounds of people talking and pairs it with string quartet and train sounds on tape. Early in the piece, in a section called Before the War, an old train porter is talking about the run from New York to Los Angeles.
From New York to Los Angeles. From New York to Los Angeles. From New York to Los Angeles. From New York.
The piece then moves on to the Holocaust, where the train sounds become shrill and alarming. And then in the final part of Different Trains, the war is over, and those early voices return, including that old porter. Same voice, same melody, but the harmony has bloomed. It's like the sun coming out. I get a shiver every time I hear it. It's just a brief moment, a few seconds, and it's gone. But it's those magical musical moments that have been occupying Anthony Tomasini lately. He's the chief classical music critic for the New York Times, and he's been writing about these fleeting moments in print and on the Times blog. He's joining me here in the studio, along with Daniel Levitin, the neuroscientist and best-selling author of This Is Your Brain on Music. Daniel's a former musician himself. Tony, Dan, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Nice to be here.
Thank you.
Tony, let me start with you because this all started with you.
Okay.
With your article, Fleeting in the Ear, Forever in the Heart. What spawned this idea about these kind of magical musical moments?
Well, it came from something personal that all my life there have just been places, moments and pieces that just grab me. And often it's not the fanciest or most complicated or most dramatic thing. Sometimes it's the opposite, something very subtle, something very strange, something you feel like, well, I've never heard that. Where did that come from?
What was your aha moment here?
Well, there were many, but the one I used in my article and I used for the first video was this experience I had with the Chopin Ballade in G minor, the first ballade. When I was like 12 years old, I got this record, Rubinstein plays the Chopin Ballades. I didn't know them, and I went downstairs and I put it on, and not a minute into the opening of the very grim opening in octaves comes this chord that this on a little sighing three-note melody, and this chord that sounded, I thought, that must be wrong. It's like this dissonant, and it just grabbed me. And then the piece, as if you haven't heard it, it just goes on. And that was my moment.
So that's the moment that does it for Anthony Tomasini, chief classical music critic of the New York Times. His recent articles for the Times have focused on these musical moments that just kind of reach out and grab you, and that's Rubinstein's recording of the Chopin First Ballade. Daniel Levitin, the musician and neuroscientist, author of This Is Your Brain on Music, is also here with us. Dan, what, on a neurological level, what's going on when Tony hears that chord and that sort of sighing, descending set of notes? What's happening?
There's an area in the brain deep inside. It's the limbic system. And deep in the limbic system, in the network of structures, we have certain neurons that are sensitive to dopamine, one of the neurohormones. Mm-hmm. And we now have a more nuanced appreciation of the pleasure center. We now divide pleasure into two phases. There's the anticipatory phase where you've got the cupcake and you haven't quite taken it to your mouth yet. And then there's the consummatory phase when you've consumed the pleasure. Opioids mediate the consumption of the pleasure. Dopamine signals the approaching pleasure. And so what I think is happening in Anthony's brain and in mine at that moment is this delicate dance between dopamine and the opioids, signaling the approaching pleasure and then the attainment of that pleasure.
Well, now that raises an interesting question, which is, Tony, when this first happened to you, it caught you by surprise. There
yes.
was no anticipation.
No, except that little three-note group. You think that, to not get too technical, that the B-flat is going down to the G. You think that it's just going to settle in G minor. And that chord comes like a warning. And my dramatic, completely non-neurological explanation is that Chopin's saying, okay, you sure you want to go on with this? This piece is going to get very heavy duty.
There's a wonderful line in your piece where you say, it kind of loses its way.
Right.
It's something very quizzical.
Right, right.
And what that said to me is that, another way to put it is, the composer is feigning
right.
a loss of control.
Right, that's very true. I'd agree with that, yeah.
And why would the composer want to do that? Well, we find it exciting. In the pop domain, I think this is one of the things that makes the Rolling Stones so exciting to so many listeners. It sounds like at any moment, in any piece of the Rolling Stones, like the train's going to jump the rails, there's going to be a terrible mess,
right.
it's going to be a calamity, but somehow they keep it on the track. And I think what Chopin is doing there is saying, I'm not going to go where you think I'm going to go,
right.
but I'm still in control. He doesn't show his control until a few notes later.
Right.
And then he shows exquisite control.
Right. One overlap between Dan's work and mine, I mean, I think readers, in my experience, music lovers, about criticism, they both are desperate to know, why does this get to me? And they also don't want to know. You know, like they want to keep it, like, emotional. And but yet, it's funny. We're all sort of ambiguous about that, I think. You know?
I mean, I guess we like to feel the magic.
Yeah.
But we don't necessarily want to see what the musician has up his sleeve.
And it's interesting you mentioned magic, because I wonder to what extent a well-executed passage like this in the Ballade No. 1 is a magic trick.
Right.
It's the composer redirecting your attention. Right?
Right.
You think the piece is going to go
right.
to that G minor.
Right.
It doesn't. It goes here instead. He's pulled a musical rabbit out of his hat.
Well, now, one of the things Tony did was he asked other people what their musical moments, those magical moments were. And Dan, you came up with like a whole list of them. I'm going to ask you about Claire and the Reasons, because they were here in our studio not too long ago. This song called Roadie, what are you hearing here that's giving you that kind of momentary thrill?
You know, for me, one of my great musical thrills is in this piece, and it's partly in the composition, but it's also in the performance. It's in the timbre. I just am so in love with the sound of Claire Muldaur's voice. I think one of the things that's happened in pop music in the last 40 or 50 years is that timbre has become a form-bearing medium. Timbre has taken on a greater importance than it had before, and we associate songs with particular singers or particular instrumentalists. We know the sound of Ravi Shankar
mm-hmm.
by his touch, and we don't confuse him with other sitar players. We know the sound of John Coltrane. We know the sound of Rubinstein. And Claire's voice is this wonderfully exotic and unique instrument that she's worked on. And in the clip we're going to hear, she does this wonderful arpeggio with it that gives me chills every time I hear it. The cascade up, and then when she gets to the top, she turns around and comes back down again in pitch. And that, with the delicateness and the underlying sense of vulnerability in her voice, just grabbed me.
All right, let's hear a little bit of the song Rhodey by Claire and the Reasons. See if it grabs you.
Rhodey likes your pearly whites, and she wants to talk in the basement of her place. Oh, place. All the time in the world to smell the flowers and walk in heels with grace. Oh, grace. Everyone is wanting her the way that she wanted to be wanted in the first place. Oh, place. And everyone is needing her the way.
Daniel Levitin picking that one, Claire and the Reasons, the song Rhodey from their album The Movie. Dan, when she sort of goes up and down the first time, and then when she goes up and down the second time on the same word, I think it's grace.
Yes.
There's a little unexpected twist in the tale.
Yeah.
Is that the moment that you were talking about?
Yeah.
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 I mean, I can definitely hear what, and again, it's that element of surprise versus novelty. Tony, do vocal works, things with text, give you the same?
I mean, you could divide all music over all time in all countries into two categories, music with words and music without words. And when you have words involved and drama and stuff, it changes everything about how you perceive the music. You know, all of a sudden, well, how does the music go fit those words? You know, and so it's completely different.
So, Dan, I mean, does the human brain listen differently when it suddenly recognizes a voice out there in the mix?
Absolutely. There are regions of the brain that are specialized through evolution to respond to human-made sounds as opposed to all other sounds. And this includes the singing voice, even sneezing, coughing, crying, sighing, breathing. All these sounds made by other humans are the collection of human sounds are represented in a particular part of the temporal cortex, very near the parts of the brain that subserve memory and meaning in language. And I wonder if, to some extent, without sounding metaphysical, if we can tell what emotion a singer is conveying. I think we can, even if they're singing ooh, ooh, or la, la. Mm-hmm. I mean,
what you're saying, though, is that when you actually have your own language activated, a whole nother part of the brain kicks into gear, right?
Yeah, the part of your brain that's trying to... obviously, there's a part of the brain that deals with speech and the meaning of particular words and the meaning of those words at that moment, because language is referential. And then we're trying with music. The richness comes in because the music itself can either support or contradict the lyrical message.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a song, I think the classic example of a song where there's a contradiction is Mack the Knife.
Right, yes. Or to pick one of the videos I did for the first chunk, I mean, the last movement of the Stravinsky Symphony of Psalms, one thing that gets to me is this incredibly world-weary, sad, harmonically sad setting of Alleluia.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, my goodness, it's overpowering.
And this is, after all, a word of jubilation.
Yes, it's so counterintuitive, and yet it's so profound. It's so sublime.
Thank you.
The conclusion of Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms, Michael Tilson Thomas's recording with the London Symphony Orchestra. Anthony Tomasini with me, chief classical music critic of the New York Times, who's been writing recently about these just fleeting musical moments, the magical moments that give you a rush, a thrill, whatever you want to call it. And Daniel Levitin, the author and neuroscientist and musician himself, trying to tell us what to call it and where it happens in the brain. What about, listeners, your musical moments? If you have a moment that does it for you, we want to hear about it. You can leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612 or leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. Again, that's 866-939-1612 or soundcheck.org. Tony, what about times when it should work, but it doesn't?
Yeah, that in my first set of videos, I talked about this moment in Siegfried opera that just in this last go-round at the Met just didn't work for me, and I can't explain it. I don't know whether I respect Fabio Luisi, the conductor, very much, but he is a kind of cool character. It might have been that. Might have been the production that distracted me that I wasn't very excited by.
But Dan, the fact that a usually dependable moment for Tony didn't happen one time brings up the question of, is this a repeatable, reliable experience? If it was, wouldn't we all have the same experience with the same moments in the same pieces?
Every time we sit down to hear a piece of music, I think it's a different experience. It's not identical. Our brain chemistry is constantly changing. It's a function of what we've eaten, whether we're tired, the kind of mood we're in. I mean, not to be too reductionist about it, but to a neuroscientist, what we call moods and emotions are simply neurochemical states. Mm. I mean, we can't measure them precisely, but maybe in 100 years when you say, well, I was feeling good at 10 o'clock today and now I'm blue, we would say, okay, well, you've got this much dopamine and this much acetylcholine and you've got this much serotonin, and so we can map that feeling to a particular cocktail. So part of it's the changes in the listener, and of course, as you point out, the performance can certainly vary. And we've done some research in our lab where we've shown that the expressions on the musicians' faces and the movements they make with their bodies have a profound effect on one's perception of the emotions, even with the sound turned off.
Right.
So if Mick Jagger was seated in a chair while he was doing Satisfaction there in the, you know, center stage at the Barclays Arena or whatever, would be a different experience from watching him strut around rooster style at the front of the stage.
There's evidence that says that's true.
Wow.
I mean, it bears repeating, classical music is a performing art. I mean, the vast majority of pop songs, pop artists are also composers. They're performing. So in a way, that is the definitive version of a song. But classical music, we're reliant on all these performers. And,
right.
And it's not even a question of some standard of excellence. It's often personal taste, too, just subjective, you know, feelings about them, that you're going to like one more than somebody else.
So the Chopin ballade example that you played for us earlier, is it only Arthur Rubinstein's?
Oh, no. I there are many, many wonderful Chopin players, but I've heard the piece distorted and pulled apart and exaggerated, and another part of your brain, the sort of intellectual part that says, wait a minute, that's not right, kicks in, and you cut off all that juicy stuff that's trying to make you emotional.
I like very much this point about the difference between the definitive version.
Right.
And what you say in your piece is that from the start of Rubinstein's account,
right,
his account.
Magnificent a Chopin player as he was, it's still his account. It's only his take.
The implication being there's not a right way that we can pin down.
No.
My favorite performer of that is Ciccolini.
Right.
And there's something about
this is Aldo Ciccolini.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's something about his style, but also for me, the recordings of his piano always make it sound like you're at the far end of the room and the piano's way off in the distance.
Right.
It gives this ethereal quality.
So that's the old record producer in you, listening with a different set of ears, I think, than many other people would bring to to that process of listening to a solo
perhaps,
piano. Yeah. So, Tony, as long as we're on the topic, and it's probably a good final topic for us, of this as a kind of communal or shared experience, you did attempt to share your experience with your readers.
Right.
You mentioned getting like 800 comments and stuff.
So far.
Is each of the 800 completely, you know, sui generis, or are you seeing certain trends, certain similarities, themes?
No, there were consensus choices, by the way. A lot of people said the same. Often significant numbers of people said the same thing, and readers would jump in and said, "Oh yeah, I love that one too." If I had a generalist, I'd say most of the moments were slow and sad. It's like somehow the really emotional things that really stick out for people. At the end of Act 4 of The Marriage of Figaro, Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, when the Count asks forgiveness. It seems so uncharacteristic. It's very interesting.
It makes you wonder what Mozart knew about neuroscience on some intuitive level, Dan, or composers in general, since they seem to be so good at this.
They are, and I think one of the things that composers know that we're just confirming in the laboratory is that we are able to keep track of musical ideas even when we're not overtly aware that we're keeping track of them. So one example of this, we just did an experiment with Beethoven's Fifth. Beethoven's Fifth goes, the main motif, the bum-bum-bum-bum, goes through many different iterations in many different keys. So that by the time the second movement is over, you've heard the bum-bum-bum-bum in at least half a dozen different keys. And we stopped the performance, and we played for the audience the theme, the bum-bum-bum-bum, the motif, in four different keys, and we asked them by way of electronic voting machines, handheld voting machines, to tell us what key they thought was the correct key, and they all picked C minor. I mean, so all of 85% of them picked C minor, where their choices were...
Which is the correct answer.
So they were able to hold on to the absolute pitch through 15 minutes or more of many, many key changes. Now, if you ask the average person, do you have absolute pitch, or can you remember a note after 15 minutes of intervening material, they'd say no. And in fact, scientists would have told you no. But Beethoven's depending on it. It doesn't work unless you've been able to hold on to it.
Right.
That is brilliant.
Yeah, that's interesting.
All right, listeners, your musical moments. We want to hear about them. Again, leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612 or a comment at soundcheck.org. Anthony Tomasini, chief classical music critic of the New York Times, continuing with his series of videos on the Times website
next week in
this series. And Daniel Levitin, musician, neuroscientist, author of books like This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs, helping us to parse what's going on here today. And guys, it's been great having you both with us on Soundcheck today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Coming up, our recent SmackDown debate over some classic holiday music sparked a question from one of our listeners about a forgotten animated TV special. We'll investigate. And an in-studio performance from guitarist Lionel Luecke. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Earlier this week, we teed up another one of our Soundcheck SmackDown debates. This one was holiday-themed. We were joined by movie critic Rafer Guzman of Newsday and radio producer Kristen Meinzer of WNYC's The Takeaway. Together, they host a podcast called Movie Date. And on Monday, Kristen and Rafer debated which medium has produced the better holiday songs, the big screen, movies, or the small screen, TV specials.
big. Size matters when it comes to good Christmas movie music. And it's the big screen.
Rafer?
I like the Christmas TV specials. I always have. Those things bring me back to childhood much more than the movies do.
It's like it was just the day before yesterday or something. Ultimately, I unilaterally declared Rafer the winner. I thought he made a good, strong case for TV specials as a source of holiday music. Then we got this voicemail from a listener named Elliot.
Why did everyone forget Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol? I loved it as a kid. I remember some of the music even now. I think they took it off the air because it's politically incorrect to poke fun at people who are hearing or seeing impaired, but that doesn't take away from the sophistication and the greatness of the music and the lyrics and the animation. But I never hear about it anymore, so I'm interested to hear people's comments on that.
Yeah. Ringle, ringle, coins when they jingle, make such a lovely sound.
Yeah, Elliot, that got us thinking about it, too. I was unfamiliar with Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, but this year happens to be the 50th anniversary of this early animated classic. And joining us on the phone is someone who can tell us all about it. Daryl Van Sitters is an animation director and producer. He also happens to be the author of a book about the special, which is also called Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol. Daryl, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So is our listener Elliot right? Did this Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol just disappear?
Yes, unfortunately he is correct. The special, after its first initial five-year run on NBC, kind of went into syndication, and over the years it gradually was picked up fewer and fewer times until it almost completely disappeared. Now it's back, and kudos to NBC for deciding to broadcast it for the 50th anniversary.
That'll be Saturday at 8 p.m., 50th anniversary broadcast of Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol on NBC. So 50 years ago, does that mean that this Mr. Magoo thing comes before Charlie Brown and Rudolph and all the others?
Yes, it does. It was the very first one, and it paved the way for the rest of them. The next one was 2 years later was Rudolph, and then Charlie Brown Christmas, and then How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Wow. So was it considered a kind of a daring thing to do at the time?
Absolutely. At the time, that nobody had ever conceived of doing an animated version of A Christmas Carol, or even had no one had even conceived of doing an animated Christmas special. And it was very daring, one, to do it, and two, to take a classic like A Christmas Carol and say, you know what, let's put Mr. Magoo and Gerald McBoing-Boing in there and see if we can't make this work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's highly improbable, but it worked.
Well, I mean, but everything about Mr. Magoo was highly improbable. I mean,
exactly.
The point is,
exactly.
He was this guy who couldn't see all that well, sometimes couldn't really see much of anything. He was voiced by Jim Backus, who fans of Gilligan's Island will know. He played the rich guy, Thurston Howell III. So he's the voice of Mr. Magoo. How closely does Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol adhere to the Dickens Christmas Carol?
Actually, it's one of the closer adaptations ever done. Whole sections, well, almost the entire script is directly from the book. There is some reordering of the ghosts, and of course, to fit it into 52 minutes at the time, there was no way they could have put the entire book in there. But it's one of the, you'll find from Dickens fans, it's one of the more closely adapted versions of the book.
And it's kind of a play within a play, right? So Mr. Magoo is starring as Scrooge on Broadway.
That's correct. At the time, Leor Gell, the man who produced the special, was concerned that people would confuse Mr. Magoo with Scrooge, and so they wanted to have a way to bookend it to really make it clear that this was not Mr. Magoo as Scrooge. It was Mr. Magoo if that makes any sense, Mr. Magoo playing the role of Scrooge.
Right.
It wasn't just suddenly we've put Mr. Magoo into this thing and there was no explanation for it.
Well, this song, I guess, serves as a kind of explainer early in the special. It's called Back on Broadway from Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Places, everybody! Magoo, your costume! You're not in costume!
Relax, my good man. I've never missed an entrance yet. I'm gonna shine, will you turn me on like the neon that you see on Broadway! Broadway!
back, back, back on Broadway.
Back on Broadway, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, an adaptation of the Charles Dickens original, an animated TV holiday classic, the first animated TV Christmas show, first broadcast 50 years ago, and finally back, airing this Saturday night on NBC at 8 p.m. We're speaking with Darryl Van Sitters, author of the book, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol. So who wrote that song that we just heard?
That was Julie Stein and Bob Merrill.
They're the ones who...
Go ahead.
They're the ones who did Funny Girl and People Who Need People.
Exactly. In fact, they were doing Funny Girl at the time they were doing A Christmas Carol, and they just did this as a little side job, and it's actually got some of the more enduring songs they've done.
So, although since the show itself didn't really endure past its original 5-year run, are these like, you know, little musical gems waiting to be rediscovered?
I believe so. Most people who grew up watching this thing can re-sing these songs by heart. They know them that well. And if someone takes the time to rediscover them, they'll find that they really have a nice feeling for the holiday. And there's a little bit of an emotional punch there when Scrooge and young Scrooge are singing Alone in the World.
Let's hear that moment from Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Where are two shoes that click to my clack? I'm all alone in the world.
A hand for each hand was planned for the world.
Why don't my fingers reach
millions of grains of sand in the world? Why such a lonely beach? Where is a voice to answer mine back?
Where are two shoes that click to my clack?
I'm all alone in the world.
Come, let us see another Christmas.
So that's Mr. Magoo as Scrooge, and he and the ghost are watching young Scrooge singing this song, and Mr. Magoo starts, as Scrooge starts singing along with him, Alone in the World, written by Julie Stein and Bob Merrill, who did Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend and the score to Funny Girl and so many other familiar songs, and did the score for Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol. Darryl, why did the show eventually sort of lose traction on TV? Is it because it was not very PC with its vision-impaired protagonist?
You have to remember, this was way before that kind of thing, and it wasn't so much that as I think they stopped putting any effort into getting it on TV again. It just went into the syndication, and the studio at the time had so many other things in syndication, they were just watching all of those, and this one never got the push that the other ones did, and I think the other ones had more ancillary material to help push them. You had Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer with a classic song that comes back every year. You had Charlie Brown Christmas. Peanuts was in front of everybody all year round. Charlie Grinch Stole Christmas had a book that started the whole thing. That was always around. This one didn't have anything quite like that. And for some reason, it went away. And it's really a shame.
Well, now, as you point out, you know, back in the 60s, political correctness wasn't quite the buzzword that it is today, but it is today. So how do you think Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol will play in 2012?
I think it will play just as well as it did 50 years ago. It's really a strong property, and the emotion and the fundamental storytelling is strong, and I think anybody who takes the time to watch it will fully appreciate what they're getting.
Well, you'll have a chance to see the Mr. Magoo Christmas Carol animated special on NBC Saturday night at 8 p.m., first aired 50 years ago and has been missing in action for many decades. We've been speaking with Darryl Van Sitters, an animation director who wrote the book, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol. Darryl, thank you very much for joining us, and happy holidays.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
This is Soundcheck.
Could we have a Christmas tree and on each branch a pulley? Some waffle jelly cake would be so nice. Could we have a stocking full of presents, Father? Could we? Some waffle jelly cake, perhaps a slice. And on the tree a star of shiny Christmas gold, a candle in a jar of razzleberry dressing.
Coming up, the globe-trotting guitarist Lionel Luecke talks about sweating his way through an early audition in front of some of the giants of jazz. And Lionel will play for us here in the Soundcheck studio. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In a video recorded last year with this singer, Gretchen Parlato, the guitarist and vocalist Lionel Luecke described himself as being from everywhere. It's actually not far from the truth. He was born in Benin, later lived in Paris, then moved to L.A., and finally to New York. His latest album is called Heritage, and it reflects upon the musical influences that all of his many homes have had on his music. Today, he joins us in the studio with his trio, bassist Eric Hodge and drummer Mark Juliana, and they're going to play for us a song called Ife, which means love.
Sing by our Macumbo Yao. Sing by our Macumbo Yao. Sing at our Macumbo Yao. He one way out, Quacumbo. Be one of my Macumba Tungo. He one of my Matinga Tungo. He one of my Matinga Tungo. Assume when I'm a Tinga Dongo. The young Matinga Dongo. Tunga Tambadanga Tinga Dongo. See young and I got you at Thank you.
That is Lionel Lueke, the guitarist and vocalist, with Derek Hodge on bass and Mark Juliana behind our drum kit, live on Soundcheck, with a song called Ife, which means Lionel Love.
Love, that's right.
And it's the lead-off track on the latest record called Heritage. First of all, thanks for coming back in. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having us here.
So what language was that in?
Ife, Yoruba.
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 So from like Nigeria, Ghana.
Nigeria, Benin, actually. Mm-hmm. Speak Yoruba
okay.
as well, yeah.
But also some clicks and vocal percussion and stuff like that, part of the mix.
That's pretty much inspiration I got from different parts of Africa, mostly South Africa.
Mm-hmm. You know, the click languages.
The click language.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then, so what's the, is that like a doubling effect that you have, a foot pedal that makes it sound like there's two or three of you singing?
Yes, it's the harmonizer.
Okay.
Yeah.
The album also, I mean, over the course of your career, you've done this a number of times, making the guitar sound different, you know, at times muting the strings to sound like a thumb piano, a kalimba. Or, as in this piece, lots of harmonics and again, very percussive effects. When you started playing the guitar, were you trying to kind of mimic the sounds of percussion instruments? Were you playing an acoustic guitar at first?
Yes, but I guess at the beginning I wasn't very aware of that. As people told me about it later on when I was here, like, yeah, you have a very different sound.
Yeah.
But I think I started as a percussion player, and that stick with me for forever, you know. So I guess I should be a drummer. And, and you know, back home, playing percussion back then, you know, it was just like you see here kids playing in the playground. So
right.
for me, it was just, I wasn't serious about it. It's just playing.
When,
you know?
When did you get serious?
Well, I got serious when I was, I think, 18, 19, because I started playing at, I started at 17.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite late. But at 18, 19, I said, well, this is what I want to do, and I have to give full time to it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And is that why you came to the States?
Yes. First of all, I went to Ivory Coast to study classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically, well, you know, I was self-taught and I wanted to learn to read music.
Mm-hmm.
And
they had a school in the Ivory Coast.
Exactly. Was,
in Abidjan and the capital.
Abidjan, yeah. Exactly. It was a classical mm-hmm. school. And after that, I went to Paris to study jazz. Paris was my first jazz education.
Mm-hmm.
And after Berkeley, I went to the Thelonious Monk Institute in Los Angeles. And from that point, well, I met Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, Terence Blanchard and many others. And
by that point, you knew enough to be impressed with these people? You knew, oh my God, this is Herbie Hancock, Terence Blanchard.
I remember my audition, you know, I was scared to play in front of them, you know.
What did you play?
Actually, I was lucky enough, they asked me to play Footprints, and that was...
Wayne Shorter.
Yeah, and it was perfect because, you know, I asked them to play an intro right away. I said, can I play an intro? I said, yeah, go ahead. So, I started making my sounds and speaking and singing in Fon, and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Fon being another language,
my language
in Benin.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Lionel Lueke. He and his trio are performing for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Going back to some live music, you want to do a song called Hope for us next?
That's right.
All right. This is Lionel Lueke and the trio live on Soundcheck.
Joe with it though. Me dey run it. Me dey bu no no si flu me kaka soya. A kon ping pong. That we jina ina.
The song is called Hope, a live performance from Lionel Lueke, guitarist and vocalist, with Derek Hodge on the bass, Mark Juliana playing the drums. The latest album by Lionel is called Heritage. It is out now. Lionel, it's always a pleasure to see you. Thank
Likewise,
you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you for having us.
This is Soundcheck. That's going to do it for the show today. Tomorrow, join me on WNYC and WNYC.org from 9 to 11 for the annual Paul Winter Solstice Concert. And then all next week, we're going to recap the year in music. We'll kick things off on Monday and Tuesday with the best live performances we heard in our studio this year. And then starting on Wednesday, we'll welcome music critics, listeners, and the Soundcheck bullpen to weigh in with their responses to our online music survey, which you can take right now at soundcheck.org. And then tune in all next week at 9 p.m. for great performances and year-end music picks. See you back here on Monday at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.